The football season is officially over, but the football season has officially begun. Welcome to Finance of Football. I'm Michael Larray.
And I'm Asla Pellet. Today, we have our first guest.
We're going to dive into soccer / football's integration into American football's biggest weekend with the NFL, and then we're also going to be talking about the fallout from the NASL antitrust lawsuit against U.S. Soccer and Major League Soccer, and we'll be joined by UCLA law professor Stephen Banks. So a lot of good stuff this episode to chat, but first, Super Bowl. What are your thoughts? Did you watch? Are you excited? What about that? Big Eagles fan?
Well, the thing is, I was watching it, and I've been hosting a pretty culinary Super Bowl party for the last three years in a row. So I was almost...
Interesting that I must have missed the invite because I wasn't over.
You were in Germany, and that's why you were not at my house this weekend, and you missed...
Fair.
And this is how much I like, Philadelphia Eagles or Philadelphia in general. I wouldn't like really... I'm team agnostic in that sense. My husband and I, our first, weekend was in Philly. We both, never been. And I suggested we visit, and we just went and, literally swim in Chili cheesesteaks for like 3 days. It was so good. So for this weekend's party, not only, most of the people in this house, probably 3-4 people were cheering for Philly. And we were eating this incredible chili cheesesteak dip. And it was a pretty uneventful game, according to people who understand this football. At one point, it was really drastic, right? And I was trying to understand, in a way, what does that mean? Like, is that like comparison to our football, right? I'm like, is this like Argentina... or like Real Madrid losing to, another team from La Liga, someone who's not like that high up in the maybe recent years as champions, and losing it like 10-0 or something. It was really like the conversation was around mostly, how does that compare to our football? And I don't know what you thought of it. Like, you understand the sport more than I do.
Yeah, well, I didn't watch. Like you said, I was in Germany. Well, actually was coming back on Sunday for the game and didn't get a chance to check it out. I actually had to watch the halftime performance on YouTube the next day just because I didn't get a chance to watch any of it, from the commercials, from the game itself, or the halftime performance. But, from what I saw and heard, obviously it wasn't much of a close contest, especially at the start, and the Chiefs made a bit of a run. But yeah, they were going for the three-peat. They would have been the first team in NFL history to win three straight. Obviously, they did not. The city of Philadelphia celebrated. I don't know if the city is still standing at this point, but let's just say we're very excited. Everyone's yelling, "Go Birds!"
Yeah,
which is great. But what I loved the most about not just Super Bowl Sunday from what I caught online, but the entire week was just kind of the integration of soccer, the global football,
totally,
into this American football moment. And we're seeing a lot of kind of crossover from, players like Harry Kane, who are NFL fans, right? Mm-hmm. And we're seeing guys in American sports who are fans of soccer. And there's just so much stuff, if I'm not mistaken, FC Bayern Munich, who I went and watched, over the weekends while I was out there, they have a good relationship with the Kansas City Chiefs. So they were clearly cheering for the Chiefs, and Patrick Mahomes, Adidas athlete, Bayern Munich, Adidas as well too. So it's like you're seeing a lot of crossover. And I think the biggest headline from the entire weekend, regardless of who won or who booed Taylor Swift or President Trump being there and that whole pomp and circumstance, was Lionel Messi.
Oh my God, that
was in attendance.
Right. He was in attendance.
That is the most significant thing. Yeah.
And not only he was in attendance with his, Inter Miami teammates, all Spanish, stars, Sergio Busquets and, Luis Suarez and Jordi. Also, I think the MLS commercial of like Messi in an NFL stadium kicking an American football dribble, bouncing it and then like hitting it through the, you know, the goal, and, you know, the American football season is over, you know, we're back at MLS. It's such an intelligent, such a great, you know, way to remind fans that, it's an exciting season for MLS. It's its 30th and it has a star, I would say, pretty big, you know, like much bigger than Patrick Mahomes or anyone who plays in the NFL compared to like the reach that Messi has, is, you know, beyond, you know, borders of United States or the league itself. It's like it's a mega star, superstar worldwide. Everybody knows his name, and to be able to watch him again, it's going to be pretty, you know, sick this season.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that just goes to the power of global football that, if I'm not mistaken, you know, Cristiano Ronaldo is the most followed person on Instagram, and Messi is number two.
Yeah.
Right. And the next the first American athlete is probably, maybe it's LeBron James, you know, and I don't think guys like Mahomes and Brady, like even sniff that. And it just shows. And the funniest thing too, is like, I'm on Instagram, you know, hearing people rant and raving about, oh, Kendrick's performance was this and I couldn't understand him, you know, and just complaining as people usually do. But the funniest thing was all of the soccer accounts that I follow, all they were doing was trolling American football by saying, oh, did you know the 2022 World Cup final was watched by 570 whatever million people worldwide? And, you know, last year's Super Bowl was only watched by 140 million. And it's like, it really puts into perspective just how big this game and this sport is on a global standpoint, that you do have Messi, who is, he's my GOAT. I know a lot of people, you know, would agree with that. Cristiano would not, but a lot of people say he's the greatest player of all time, and just the impact that he has just showing up and just attending, right? Like he didn't do anything. He didn't go out at the halftime performance and dance like Serena Williams did or anything like that. Like he was just there and he took a photo, you know, with his Inter Miami teammates and obviously starred in the commercial at the end of the game. And it just shows like how big of a star he is. And I think that's where we as Americans get a little hung up, that we sit here and we think, oh, it's Tom Brady and it's Mahomes and it's these basketball stars. And it's like, yes, they are big, but Messi and these soccer stars are exponentially bigger.
Yeah.
Right? Multiply by 10, 100, whatever number. And it's like, then you're just scratching the surface of how big these stars are. And kudos to Adidas and MLS and Apple and anyone who was involved. Like, I think Rodri was there and Sammy Kadira.
Oh, yeah. And Rodri was there too. That was
right. Yeah. They're doing Radio Row. And
Danny Rojas was there. Danny Rojas, like Ted Lasso's, you know, famous, you know, Mexican player. He was there doing press. Like, this whole week was also a great moment for every brand to activate using the platform that Super Bowl gives. Super Bowl is perhaps the most important match of the year, but also it's the most important week of the year for sports business in general. And you and I always, you know, we're kind of chat about this, like, what is going to happen when we are hosting the World Cup in the United States, and how that, you know, 4 weeks and a half, almost like 5 weeks period in the United States is going to probably set the standard for what sports business deals gonna look like in the future, because you don't have a week, you have a month to like bring the brands, bring the famous people, do activations in every city. Like, you know, not only in one city, in multiple cities. It's just going to be this in steroids, basically.
Yeah. And I think the big thing with the World Cup is you're speaking to global audiences, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if you're a brand and you're really trying to market to a certain audience or region, you can strategically go to those matches, right? If you're trying to reach an audience in Asia, for example, you're not going to go to a match between, you know, Canada and Ukraine. It doesn't make sense. So you can be more strategic about it. Whereas you had all these other brands and sports properties, whether it was UFC or WWE or, you know, whoever, that people aren't really associated with American football are doing Radio Row, and they're doing these hits and they're plugging their products and they're wearing, you know, whatever t-shirt of whatever brand is paying them to be there. And it's like, you can do that, like you said, on steroids for an entire month all around the continent, as opposed to just in New Orleans or in one location where the Super Bowl is. So I think, you know, brands, if they're not already thinking about this, they should be. And I hope, you know, we obviously can be there and benefit in terms of getting some interviews for the podcast, any of the other opportunities that we have too, just doing, you know, doing some interviews, getting some content with some amazing, you know, athletes who are interested in soccer. And I think, you know, people really need to realize that you can be fans of more than one sport. You can be fans of more than one team. God forbid you wake up and you watch a soccer match and then you watch, you know, Red Zone all day. Like, you can do that. And soccer/football is the global game for a reason. And I think a lot of people would really miss that opportunity if they don't take advantage of it. Not even waiting until 2026. Start at the Club World Cup, you know? Like, why not?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And of course, like, speaking of competing for eyeballs ahead of the Club World Cup, like you said, and World Cup, I think this is a good moment to pause and bring our guest for the week, who is going to walk us through the aftermath of another competition that we discussed on our first episode, the NASL versus US Soccer and MLS case. Let's bring Stephen Bank, the Paul Hastings Professor of Business Law at UCLA School of Law. He is a leading expert in business taxation and legal history. Professor Bank has authored multiple books and published extensively on corporate tax policy. But beyond that, he's also an expert on soccer law, bringing his legal and business expertise to the game and game's biggest legal debates, from corporate tax reform and also legal intricacies of international football. We have a fascinating conversation ahead. Let's dive in. Hello, Stephen.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, that was a heck of an intro and definitely a heck of a first guest for us. And I know we did an episode on the NASL antitrust lawsuit against US Soccer and Major League Soccer. And, you know, Stephen, recently the jury delivered their verdict and they said that not guilty on all accounts. So I just love your initial thoughts on that verdict.
Yeah. So just to be precise about what they said that the plaintiff, North American Soccer League, failed to prove that a relevant market, and the way it's the jury instructions, the jury verdict form is written. If you fill out, you know, we agree they failed, you know, it's yes or no. Did they prove a relevant market? If you say no, you get to skip all the way down to the basically, and so therefore everything is null. You don't have to answer any of the questions on each of the individual claims. And they had to do that for two counts, the one relating to anti-competitive behavior with respect to a D1, the D1 leagues, and with respect to the D2 leagues. But they just had to answer that twice. So we don't know actually how they felt about everything else, but they felt that the plaintiffs failed to meet their burden on the first threshold claim. And so it's an interesting question, actually. And I don't mean to be hyper-technical. I'm a law professor. I'm allowed to be, I guess, hyper-technical, but
judges will allow it.
So here's the interesting part about this. The jury very well could have decided that NASL didn't prove anything, right? You know, like we reject every one of their claims and looked at that said, if you push, you know, no here, you get to skip the rest of this and leave early. And, you know, sounds good to me, you know, like I'm out. Or could have been, well, actually, we thought like a lot of this stuff was really problematic. But once we agreed that they didn't meet the threshold claim, then, OK, I guess we're out. You know, so we don't know. We don't actually know exactly what the jury viewed of each individual claim. We could guess. But a lot of cases in antitrust come out because you fail to meet this market relevant, prove a relevant market. And that's actually like, I don't know whether it's because of the psychology of, you know, fill out the one thing, no, and you're done, or whether it's they just failed.
I mean, I'm going to jump in right here because I was there watching. First of all, it was a long trial. It was weeks of information that they received I think around 8 hours a day. They looked, the jury looked a little exhausted because these people are not like, you know, they're not journalists, they're not football. They didn't even know anything about these leagues, right? So when they were being selected for this jury duty. And the three lawyers gave their closing arguments, which was really lengthy. It was very detail oriented. And plus that morning, the judge really walked the jury thoroughly through the process of how they should approach the case. And that's when you, what you said, it makes it's very important. There were so many details in that note that they just went with no. And like 3 hours later, they were out there and they had a verdict. I thought it was going to take a few days for them to come to a decision because there were a lot of things. And I think some of the questions we have are around that. Like, obviously, the most eyebrow-raising moment for this, you know, trial was when Cosmos owner Raka Comiso was identified as the person behind the burner Twitter account that was trolling the U.S. Soccer Federation president, former president Sunil Gulati, and the MLS commissioner, and just about everyone associated with the defendants. I think maybe this, you know, revelation affected their judgment. I don't know. And ultimately hurt the NASL's case for proving there was a monopoly. They were so maybe stuck in these arguments that made most sense for a regular person listening in, right?
Yeah. So, you know, someone asked me before the trial started, so is this trial going to be enormously significant, you know, like legal precedent? And the original complaint had two major counts. One count was that the professional league standards are illegal, are a restraint on trade. You know, the just the existence of a standard that requires you to meet various criteria like ownership, wealth, a size of stadium, geographic, various other things, that alone was a restraint on trade, was anti-competitive. And then the second was that, as applied to NASL, it was done in an anti-competitive fashion. And over the summer, the judge ruled that, and it was actually a former judge, this has been through multiple judges, but it's 7.5 years, you know, people are entitled to retire and move on and all sorts of things. And actually the pandemic got in the way massively because caseloads increased because they had been, criminal cases had been delayed because they want to be in person and any event. So it changed a lot of things. So you had multiple judges, but the past judge said that granted summary judgment on the first claim, this count about the pro league standards. And once they did that, and we can talk about why they did that. And I think that I think it's actually NASL, to be honest, abandoned that claim more than they were ruled against on it. But once that claim was over, this was a big case about this factual circumstance, like a lot of very individual facts. And so I said, it's going to be your garden variety. You know, is there a smoking gun? Is there some like very specific thing? But it's not going to be something like that's going to change the landscape for U.S. soccer, unless, of course, NASL wins and wins a lot of money and that, you know, bankrupts and, you know, the U.S. soccer. Of course, that would have a significant effect. And if they won, if NASL won, that, you know, might have a kind of a disciplining effect on U.S. soccer because they'd want to try to not have this happen again. And what do we do and all that? But in general, it was not going to be a big legal precedent. And so what was going to be was a case where there's a lot of entertainment value around revelations. I think that's not far from what Rocco Camiso was seeking. Like, that is, he didn't want to be the butt of the, you know, the information, you know, the revelations. But I think he thought that if we get to trial, they'll uncover a lot of uncomfortable truths about U.S. soccer that will be, you know, embarrassing. And U.S. soccer will, you know, be humbled to some extent. And I think it just went opposite of what he thought, because U.S. soccer stuck to the script, to be honest. I mean, they were coached. You could tell they were coached by lawyers. Like, they were giving the same answers. Of course we didn't consider NASL. We never entered our mind NASL, you know, things like that. I'm sure that they were coached to say that. And to be fair, I don't doubt that they're just, you know, they're focused on their own league, and, you know, then on a day-to-day basis, they're not thinking about NASL unless they're like in the same city as NASL, you know, an NASL team. But so I'm not saying they were lying. I'm just saying that like that they were sticking to a script that the, you know, a lawyer had prepped them on. Hmm. And I have a feeling NASL just wasn't as well organized, but also those people are all gone from NASL. Right. Like, I mean, other than I think they hired a new commissioner. So I'm not sure if any of those people are still employed by NASL.
Yeah. No one.
Rocco Camiso. He's not employed by NASL, but he's still a current owner, technically, I suppose, if there's a team left. And so they're all people who are, you know, spread to the winds. They may have met with the lawyers a few times, but they're not like employees who are saying, here's what we are supposed to say, you know? And I just don't know that they were sticking to the script. Mm-hmm. But they also had bad facts. I mean, just to be honest, it was always going to be a hard case for NASL. It was an example of a case where you wish you had a different client, probably. The lawyers probably wish they didn't. I mean, what I mean by that is like, if a law firm or a legal organization is pursuing a like civil justice case, right? They want to reform something they consider is unfair in society. They handpick the plaintiffs who are going to be the lead plaintiffs, who are going to have great stories that just like totally fit and are going to be unflappable on the stand and very sympathetic to the jury and all those things to make their bigger case. And this NASL case was like, it was filed really as a sort of a civil justice claim, and you know, now that's a very poor comparison to pro soccer because we're not talking about, you know, civil rights and various things like that. But it is, you know, they wanted to reform U.S. soccer, and originally this case was not for money. Like they only wanted a change to the pro league standards and wanted to make an open market and all those things. And so that would be considered for a lot of people and who are soccer fans, kind of a admirable goal, but it isn't something where you picked the right, you couldn't just like pick your lead plaintiff. You know, you had NASL, and NASL had lots of warts, lots of issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and kind of going along those lines, I'd love your thoughts on Carmelo Anthony, right? Like they brought in Rocco Camiso and all these other high profile names, but it seemed they kind of shot themselves in their own foot with bringing in Carmelo Anthony, because a couple years ago, you know, he gave testimony being like, oh, it was Hurricane Maria led to the folding of Puerto Rico FC, the club he owned. And then now they bring him into this trial and he's like, oh, no, it's this monopoly, this alleged monopoly that MLS and U.S. soccer have. So it's like he's speaking out of both sides of his mouth. And I think, you know, going back to your point about them not kind of doing their own homework or sticking to a script, it seems like they didn't really help themselves with that. So, you know, I'd love your thoughts on just, you know, kind of his testimony and how it was so contradictory. Like if I was on the jury, I'd sit there and be like, wait a second, you know, I'd have more questions than wanting to side with them.
Yeah, I don't know what their thought was in going after Anthony. The only thing I can say is that, so you can't just bring someone into the witness stand who hasn't gone through depositions, right? Mm-hmm. And the deposition, it's not like you can just, well, let's bring this other person in. I mean, that's like if you watch Law and Order and you see like sort of the surprise witness comes in or something like that. That doesn't really happen.
Carmelo's just hanging out like, and they're like, hey, come in here. We need your help for a second.
I am so upset now. I watch every episode of Law and Order and it doesn't happen that way. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I hate to burst your bubble. They have to get that done in an hour. So, you know, this is a case that was started in the fall of 2017. And so you have to like think, and that was for a preliminary injunction, but then it converts into they had an amended complaint where they added MLS in like March of 2018. So from that point forward, this is a different case. And they're, you know, you have to develop witnesses and both sides have to be able to depose them and all that kind of stuff. And so I don't know when they deposed Carmelo Anthony, for example, but it was years ago, right? Like, it's not like it happened, you know, 6 months ago and they decided, whoa, this guy's whatever. And when the longer you let passage of time occur, you know, the more these guys, like their story changes or they forget or they whatever. And so it's always a risk. when you have a long-standing trial of people who have long ago left the organization. I mean, they had like, you know, maybe the most, I don't know if he was reliable as a witness, but I just, the guy who, like Eric Stover, who was with the Cosmos and with Camiso, you know, is a guy, okay, he's like was central, but like a lot of these people in the periphery who owned clubs, I had no idea what they were gonna, you know, what you would think they would say. And I'm not sure they knew, like, you know, and Anthony is not a guy who's likely to have spent lots of time with the lawyers prepping for this. And so I don't know why they even put him on. Like, I'm not sure exactly what they were going to get out of this. I think there was this view that maybe the a jury in New York would be sympathetic to Carmelo Anthony, but it just, I don't know.
Well, actually something worth mentioning here is the judge called them on it and warned the plaintiff's lawyer for calling Carmelo Anthony and say, hey, are you trying to bring witnesses? Well, just, you know, so that jury will sympathize with this particular person. And that was, if you know how it is, you just stayed after, you know, when the jury is released for the day, the judge actually talks to both lawyers and like warns them about what they've done during the day. For those who are listening to us, like we're really discussing this very complex case between U.S. soccer and NASL. And we have Professor Stephen Bank from UCLA telling us the details of it. And so this is one of those moments where I think it's important to understand that judges, one of his, you know, main, I guess, responsibility is to make sure nobody's going off rails, bringing random people and let them do whatever they want in a courthouse to manipulate a jury. I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier, because, you know, U.S. soccer and MLS both were very well prepared. You said the lawyers prepare their witnesses. And they leaned on bringing witnesses to prove that NASL had many problems before even the sanctioning, D1 sanctioning, and then later the D2 sanctioning was changed. However, I think NASL's point was, throughout the case, which I heard bits and pieces of it, but I don't know why they didn't lean on that, while MLS had many years to overcome difficulties, and U.S. soccer gave them a lot of leeway to do that from 1999 all the way to 2010 almost, NASL said, why didn't you give me another year for me to stay as a D1? Why didn't you guys let us do? So in that case, I was confused most of the time. And you've been following the soccer ecosystem in the United States. I don't know if like years ago and before we even started this trial, was that something in the soccer ecosystem? People talked about this, and was there any other, you know, information you can share with us from past experiences in this case, or not even this case, this situation?
Yeah, I mean, so if you're going to say like the, you know, bad fact for NASL is like they, you know, like traffic and their connection with the FIFA indictment scandal and their own kind of incompetence in a variety of ways and some of the troubles of their teams. The bad fact for MLS is that MLS had two big advantages that, you know, you could call subsidies or whatever they are. One was clearly subsidy-like, at least, which was Soccer United Marketing, which was a organization founded by MLS owners that they brought, U.S. Soccer brought in and gave them the rights to be the main organization marketing their TV rights for U.S. national team games, and bundled that with Major League Soccer, and so that allowed the owners to make money off of that, even though they were it wasn't Major League Soccer making money. It was the owners. But mm-hmm. You know, it's certainly something that made it profitable and also raised the profile of Major League Soccer's games. Right. So that's one thing. And the second is that they had this long period where Major League Soccer, U.S. Soccer was trying to prop up Major League Soccer. And they both had to as a condition of hosting the 1994 World Cup was to generate a D1 league. And then you know, they didn't want him to go under, right? And there was a period of time when there was a possibility that Major League Soccer would close and there'd be no D1 leagues. It wasn't like there were competitors. Mm-hmm. So that's something that I think NASL tried to push that. Couple problems with it from, I think, the narrative that was set up. I don't know what the truth is, but the narrative. U.S. Soccer had an obligation to try to get a D1 professional league going. Again, I said because of the World Cup, but also if you think about a governing body, like that's what you need to, if you're going, U.S. Soccer's governing body status is really with respect to the U.S. national teams. It's a membership organization with respect to some other aspects of its operations. It's a very sort of odd or organization because it's got multiple things. FIFA sanctions it for purposes of governing like the professional leagues, but the U.S. government through Congress and the International Olympic Committee, U.S. Olympic Committee, sanctions it for governing for purposes of selecting national teams. But so you would think from the national team side, you want to have a D1 league because if you're going to get enough U.S. players to be at the level that they can represent your nation, you need to build up the league. So at a time when there was no competitors, right, and they were almost going to collapse, right? So the MLS was at one point owned by three individuals because all these teams were going to collapse. And so they had to buy up the teams. Although to be fair, Major League Soccer is always a single entity. So they weren't really owning, they were just operating those teams that didn't have an operator. The argument is that MLS was given lots of leeway and NASL wasn't given that leeway. Maybe that argument would have sold. Again, that has nothing to do with why the box that the jury ticked on the jury verdict form doesn't actually say what their view was on that aspect of this. Yeah. And that's actually important. Like, don't lose sight of that because we don't know what they would have said on that. We know that they said there wasn't a relevant market proven, and I can explain that, but it's, you know, that's a big deal. Like, if they can't prove the relevant market, then they're not there, which is basically saying that they don't have market power to, even if they did conspire to prevent them from succeeding, they didn't actually have the market power to accomplish it. So if NASL didn't succeed, it was a bunch of other things. But put that aside, the argument I think that MLS was and U.S. Soccer was making, which was, I guess, might have been persuasive, was that MLS might have had issues, but they're always working towards solving them. They had a plan. And when you look at it in retrospect, it was clearer that they had a plan. Plan was to get out of football stadiums owned by other people where they're leasing from somebody else, have their own stadiums to grow nationwide in markets where they had stable ownership and, you know, had the sufficient conditions so that they would be, you know, strong, and that would also allow them to have a TV contract, you know, a variety of things that they did. And it's one of the negatives, to be honest, of this case going on for as long as it did, because like when you look now in retrospect, they had a plan, it worked. You could say, well, that worked because they got subsidized. I mean, maybe, but the argument that U.S. Soccer and MLS was saying is that they asked NASL, what's your plan, you know, every time there's a waiver, and they did not provide anything. That was the testimony. And there was really no contrary testimony from the NASL people, as far as I know, where they said, oh, no, here was our plan. The plan was actually looked worse because what they were doing was bringing in these underfinanced groups and people who didn't know what they were doing, and then corrupt people, right? Like, that's the plan, is let's bring in, you know, let's bring in Traffic, you know, this like a corrupt organization that's, you know, then got indicted, you know, and Michael Davis, you know, I mean, you know, it's just one of these things like where the people they brought in were not good. So that may have been what the jury could have bought that argument. But I do think there's a difference between the kinds of waivers, like, we just want to waive because we're not going to, like, we're not going to meet it, or here's what we're doing to meet it, but it's going to take us 3 years to get there. I do think that's the argument, at least, that U.S. soccer was throwing out there and wasn't really rebutted, as far as I know.
Stephen, any last, you know, comments around this topic before we wrap it up for the week?
So here's my best guess on appeal, right? I could see them appealing. NASL put out a statement saying that they were considering legal options to appeal, but they did like several paragraphs before they got to the, but we are still considering legal options for appeal, you know, all our options for appeal, tracing how the developments in U.S. soccer since they filed their original lawsuit, which they, you know, they attributed all to their lawsuit, or at least in part to their lawsuit. They said the reform, the change of commissioners, the end of the Soccer United marketing agreement, but then they also said equal pay for women's soccer, which I don't believe at all was part of NASL. But they did a bunch of things, and they said, and so we think we've done a lot for the good of soccer. I think that was a face-saving or graceful way for them to kind of exit the lawsuit, because I don't think the lawsuit is going anywhere on appeal. I mean, it doesn't mean they couldn't possibly revive it on appeal. There's always legal errors that a court could pick up on. But I think that was, I'm guessing that Rocco Camiso, sitting there on the witness chair, realized how much money he spent on this. And he said, forget this. What would I doing this for? And then the day that statement came out from NASL saying, look at all the good things that this lawsuit did. We have an abandoned appeal, but, you know, we feel good about what we've done. There was a press release about a new apparel sponsorship agreement between Admiral and the New York Cosmos with a new line of gear. And I have this feeling, since they came out on the same day, that Camiso said, all right, it's time to make some money, right? Like, we need revenue.
I sent this to Michael. I was like, Michael, look what's happening. And we were surprised about that, actually. Remember, Michael? I'm like, look at this. New York Cosmos is coming back with a new kit. Like, why would they do that? They don't even have a team. But yeah, it's a great moment to perhaps use the spotlight and news have, you know, brought them back from, you know, ashes. And why not having a retro collection of kits when sports and fashion is so intertwined today? Like, Michael has an incredible collection of jerseys, and it's a fashionable, you know, statement when you think about it. And Cosmos is a strong brand, and that's probably another, you know, thought for another episode, but such an important brand. Will it go down with this case ending, or would it come back from the ashes as a brand and start from, you know, Division III all the way up to become a strong, you know, franchise one day?
I'm sure they were working on this long before the verdict came out, so hoping that this would be the triumphant return of the brand. I don't know how the verdict affected their, you know, their sales, but they'll recoup a little bit of the money. But yeah, it is. I think they're right now a brand, and they probably harm their brand if anything. But most of their brand was not soccer fans of the NASL 2.0. It was, you know, historic, my era NASL with Pele and Chinaglia and Beckenbauer and all those guys. So,
don't date yourself.
Were you a
don't
Cosmos fan? Yeah, you don't date yourself. But were you a big fan of soccer back then when Cosmos?
I was a big fan of soccer. I mean, I had on my wall growing up, my room at my parents' house. I had. I didn't buy these separately. It was like I remember going to the soccer store, because, you know, you get your cleats, and, you know, saying to them when the posters are done, when you're, you know, going to the next poster, can I have, you know, one of those? And I would get a couple of those, put them on my wall. I wasn't a Cosmos fan particularly. I grew up in Cleveland, and we didn't have an NASL team, but we had really, NASL was, I was pretty young. So there's ASL, there was a Cleveland Cobras. And then when I was really a little older, it was indoor soccer was the only thing going on in the U.S. NASL collapsed in 1983, and it was the major indoor soccer league, Cleveland Force, named after Star Wars, the Star Wars Force. You know, so that's how long ago. But, you know, that's that's the, for people my era, when you say, oh, they propped up MLS, they had nothing. They had indoor soccer, and that was it. We were playing in like hockey arenas, you know, and so, yes, they had to work hard to get. NASL had this massive runway created by Major League Soccer having been in existence for, you know, a decade or more before NASL 2.0 started, that, you know, they benefited off of that to some extent, the raising exposure. But yeah, I mean, I was a fan of New York, but it's like you could watch those games like maybe ABC Wide World of Sports, you know, once a week. Maybe there'd be a game, maybe there'd be one NASL game, but generally it was like you didn't get to watch much. You watched your local team.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Professor Bang, thank you so much for taking the time. We really appreciate the conversation. Again, we'll sure you'll be a regular guest here just to talk about all the other fun stuff, ProRel and U.S. investment abroad and just all the great stuff that's happening in the finance of football. So thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Stephen. Thank you again for joining us.
Sure. Happy to do it.
What a great conversation and insight from Professor Stephen Bank at the UCLA School of Law. You know, we could sit here and talk about soccer for hours. But we have other episodes to record. He's got classes and different things to teach. So that's it for this episode of Finance of Football. Big shout out to our producer, Ethan Joseph, and our production assistant, Louis Yeo. We'll be back for the next episode soon. So be sure to tune in, follow on social media, like, subscribe, send to your friends, and let's keep this train rolling. Thanks a lot.